You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
The T-Biz Podcast delivers T-News that you need to know. A recap of the week's major headlines with commentary and cultural trends hosted by Dan Bolton. It is the voice of origin for tea professionals and enthusiasts worldwide.
The Tea Biz podcast and blog connect you directly to experts in the tea lands. Listen as their voices reveal the news, innovations, cultural insights, and consumer trends that most impact the industry. Paired with Tea Journey, a digital magazine for tea enthusiasts, the Tea Biz portal is a global resource for everyone who loves tea. Hello, everyone. Here are this week's headlines. World Tea Expo names Beverage Challenge winners. A resilient Ukraine retains its taste for Russian tea. And Boca One Thalawa is certified as the first climate-neutral tea estate. More in a minute, but first, this important message.
What makes a perfect cup of Ceylon tea? The perfect cup is from the tea businesses that ensure the protection of all the children living within their tea estates. We salute Keilani Valley, Telawakili, Boga Wanthalawa, Harana, and Eliptia Tea Estates. Support Save the Children, Sri Lanka.
The World Tea Expo drew a worldwide community of tea professionals to Las Vegas this week for 2 days of memorable conference presentations, tastings, and awards. The show featured several networking opportunities, from informal meetups to several Meet the Speaker chats at the tea bar. Winners of the new competition, known as the 2024 Beverage Challenge, attracted entries from around the world, including brands from so relatively unknown regions, Guatemala, New Zealand, and Myanmar, as well as Vietnam, Sri Lanka, China, Japan, India, Kenya, and Nepal. Quote, the Beverage Challenge celebrates diversity, innovation, and flavor, and the artistry of tea, end quote, said Tim McLucas, vice president of Barn Restaurant Group. Quote, I commend each of these participants for showcasing such quality products in this spirited competition. Congratulations to the winners of these prestigious titles. End quote. The grand champion was Sira Devi Tea Estate, which was also named Best Liquor for its White Silver Wings Tea. Brook 37 TNTA won the Best Leaf Award and Best Oolong for its Moonlight Stroll Oolong. Fishhook won the Best Green Tea, Panelkunda Tea Factory won for the Best Black Tea, and Wuhan Organic took the top prize for Pu'er. This new competition allows brands to highlight their finest teas globally and gain recognition from industry experts. The panel of judges sampled and scored the teas live on the World Tea Expo stage based on leaf style, make, cup character, liquor appearance, and overall finish. Visit the T-Biz blog for more in-depth coverage of World Tea Expo. The Ukrainian publication Sokolinofo, a news publication covering Western Ukraine, posted an insightful review of the country's war-torn market this week. Surprisingly, Russian-based tea ventures and their Ukraine-based factories have emerged as private label manufacturers and continue to supply a large quantity of tea. The country's official policy is that business executives and companies at war are enemies, with no place in Ukraine. Since the invasion, the National Security and Defense Council has imposed sanctions on many Russian companies and individuals. Ukrainian companies under Russian control were confiscated and shares were transferred to state ownership. In 2022, before Russian troops invaded, about 40% of the tea market was Russian brands, with Russian Oremy Ukraine at 29% market share and Russian-owned May Ukraine at 15% share. These two companies distributed many popular brands, including Tess, Princess Nuri, Maisky, Curtis, and Greenfield. At the time, there were 100 teas on the typical supermarket shelf, including many popular European brands. The brand names have since changed, but the Ukrainian factories that produce Maisky and Curtis continue operating. May is now known as Tropolsko-Solints, the tea family, with new brands Savoia Linia and Reasonable Choice. The factory continues to blend and pack private label brands. According to Sukhanalnofu, Tunofi Sunols retains about an 8% market share. Quote, Oremy products have not been sold on the shelves of national retail chains since the spring of 2022, end quote, writes Sokolanofu, which shared the work of journalists at the newspaper Ekonomishkaya Pravda. Court seized UAH 52 million from Oremy Ukraine, which was given to the armed forces. The company was later fined UAH 80 million for concealing information about its ownership, but the office's factory and production capacity remain as they were before, reports EP. In 2023, Ukrainians purchased 25 million, that's about 7.8 billion UAH worth of tea, down from the amount spent before the war. The formerly Russian-owned ventures lost share but never left and have since rebuilt their share to about 15% of their 40% presence in fast-moving consumer goods. Reporters investigating Ukraine's gray trade in goods and contraband report finding packages of branded teas packaged as recently as December, including Greenfield and Princess Nuri, in several lesser-known markets. Although sales of Oremy, now known as TS Trade, and May, now known as Tripoli Solons, are well below their peak, each of the two companies is approaching a double-digit recovery, with TS Trade now beginning shipments nationwide. The Climate Neutral Group, CNC, in the Netherlands has certified Sri Lanka's Bogawanthalawa tea estate as climate neutral, a sustainability designation held by few and the first to be awarded in tea. CNC was created to advance the work of the Paris Agreement by aiding clients in reducing and offsetting greenhouse gas emissions. Bogawanthalawa has earned an impressive list of certifications and is the first tea-growing venture in the world to meet the climate positive standard. The tea estate is certified by Rainforest Alliance and Fair Trade. It is carbon neutral and operates at 100% renewable energy. In 2023, the tea estate's tea-making process significantly reduced emissions to a footprint lower than baseline, earning emissions credits from its hydropower plant. Bogawanthalawa's net zero energy certification highlights its achievement in balancing energy consumption with renewable energy production, significantly reducing its carbon footprint. The company's comprehensive approach to sustainability serves as a model for other organizations. Almas Mark, our director and CEO of Bogawanthalawa Tea Ceylon, said, quote, our international reputation and accolades are not only significant achievements in managing our carbon footprint, but also add to our competitive advantage in the global market. Combining the expertise of our tea masters and their specialized knowledge, along with product innovation, supply chain resilience, and a dynamic team, we are fully aligned to shape the industry's future. Next, Arvinda Anantharaman in Bengaluru reports on this week's India Tea News.
India Tea News for the week ending March 22, 2024. The Northeastern Tea Association held a biennial general meeting in Golaghat, Assam on 13th March. Kamal Jalan, chairman of the association, spoke on the challenges facing the Assam tea industry and also the way forward. The association spoke against the latest government order for 100% of tea dust to be sold via the auction system, calling it detrimental for the survival of the industry. They also raised the issue of food safety compliance and have asked for greater awareness amongst malt growers, increased testing and facilities to test at factories, and a roadmap towards achieving 100% compliance with food safety standards. The association also raised the issue of stopping tea production in winter, which is now a practice in North India, and have said they are not in favor of reducing production, but rather would like a focus on a generic promotion of tea in the domestic market with an aim for per capita consumption of 1 kilo. Safety is in focus through 2024 from the looks of it. Indian Tea is seeing a renewed and determined march towards food safety after coming under constant flak. 2024 opened with the Food Safety Standards Association of India calling for more compliance and partnering with the Tea Board to see how this can be affected. And now it's we're seeing it in action in the Nilgiris last week. The FSSAI led a training on safe and hygienic tea production practices for small tea growers. And in North Bengal, the domestic certification body trustee partnered with the Association of Small Tea Growers for training on pest control and soil health management and pesticide use for small tea growers. And India is now set to send delegates to Iran. Iran was once a big buyer of Indian tea, but has ceased to import the same volumes as before. The Mint reported that tea shipments to Iran have dropped from 54.45 million kilos in 2019 to 5.16 million kilos in 2023. With Iran still being considered an important export market, a trade delegation is being planned to dialogue with Iranian authorities. But shipping disruptions and payment challenges aside, Iran had an internal crisis in November last year when tea importer Debj Tea Company was embroiled in a $3.4 billion embezzlement scandal. Besides Iran, India's tea exports to the UAE have also dropped by 25% from 2022 to 2023.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Hello, I'm Bogdan, a passionate tea drinker and the inventor of the ultimate tea machine, the Brewmaker One. Preparation is key to making fine tea. Sequential steepings deliver the best taste possible and unlock the true value of whole leaf teas and botanicals. Brew automates that process without using any pots or capsules. This simple-to-operate smartphone-controlled device stores steeping profiles to consistently make great tea at the push of a button. Brew also reduces time, waste, and energy. That's because I engineered the brew to remember control settings for temperature, brewing time, and quantity. Using my patented process lets you stack, steep simply and conveniently.
Safeguarding the right to a decent life for everyone in tea benefits the industry. Equity and transparency along the entire supply chain encourage retention and productivity, enabling sustainable supply. Mandates for due diligence reporting of human rights and enforcement lie ahead. London-based Thirst is midway through a three-year assessment of human rights in tea. This week, managing editor Arvinda Anantharaman speaks with Thirst co-founder and CEO Sabita Banerjee to assess progress and the challenges that remain. Sabita Banerjee was born and raised on tea plantations in Kerala and Assam. She has spent nearly 20 years working in ethical trade and international development, holding strategic posts at Oxfam and the Ethical Trading Initiative.
London-based Thirst, the International Roundtable for Sustainable Tea, a non-profit human rights initiative, launched a three-year human rights impact assessment study in 2022. The study aims to listen and understand the human rights concerns in the tea sector and bring stakeholders together to seek solutions. We've been following Thirst's study from the start, and now with phase two complete, we caught up with CEO and founder Shobhita Banerjee to hear about the findings and next steps. Shobhita is an economic and social justice consultant, campaigner, writer, activist with over two decades in international development and trade justice. Thank you, Shobhita, for joining us at TBiz. I've been glad to keep up with the study by Thirst and to keep up with what you've been doing. So really looking forward to hearing what you have to share with us today on phase two.
Thank you for having me on.
I was reading the report that you've already published on the Thirst site, and I think there's a lot of things there that are current preoccupations with the industry folks. But before we go into that, if you can just once again introduce the study that you planned, what phase one was and phase two was, that would be good for our listeners.
Thanks, Arvinda. The report is the second one in our three-year human rights impact assessment of the global tea industry. It's quite a unique study in the sense that it's an independent human rights impact assessment. It hasn't been commissioned by any company, although we have had contributions towards it from various companies and organisations. And so that's one unique thing about it. It's also, we're doing it over 3 years, which I think is quite unusual for a human rights impact assessment. And the fact that that it's at an industry level is quite unusual. Human rights impact assessments are usually done by one company of one of their supply chains to one country. Whereas we're not looking at every single one of the 60 countries where tea is grown and every one of the thousands of companies involved, but we're looking at how the industry itself operates. Because we believe that there are probably a lot of answers from that perspective about how the human rights of tea workers and farmers may be impacted. The last thing that's quite unique about the study is that we're not intending to present the tea industry with a list of recommendations, but we are pulling together as much information as possible that will help them with other stakeholders to sit down and come up with the recommendations themselves. We're hoping that we'll be able to get them together with NGOs, with trade unions, with different stakeholders and actors throughout the tea value chain to work out solutions to the problems that we've highlighted using the analysis that we've done on the root causes of those breaches. And it's then for them to come up with solutions that will be realistic, but also because the trade unions and NGOs would be involved as well, that would also, you know, sufficiently meet the needs of the tea workers and farmers. So in year one, just 2022, we published a literature review which outlined how the tea industry works, the scope and scale of it. We listed many, many human rights standards, laws, regulations, policies from international level down to individual company level. And we then looked at the reality for tea workers and farmers as reported in a wide range of reports from the media, from academics, from government, from NGOs, from trade unions. And we identified a significant gap between the human rights in principle for the tea workers and farmers and the human rights in practice. And then this last year, we then did this root cause analysis of that gap between the human rights in principle and human rights in practice. And you asked about how difficult it was. It was actually, I mean, it was obviously a lot of work because we interviewed and did surveys and did focus groups of around 200 industry stakeholders. So it was a lot of work. But in terms of difficulty, people were very, very willing to speak to us. And that was very heartening. We probably went where it was easiest to go. We focused on South Asia and East Africa, partly because that's where we have the most contacts, but also because Thirst is based in the UK and a lot of the retailers and brands that we interact with are UK based, and they buy a lot of their tea from South Asia and East Asia, and East Africa. In this study, we haven't looked very closely at East Asia and Southeast Asia. That's something that we're hopefully will do in another study later on. We were very pleased at how willing people were to speak to us. We also visited a lot of tea estates and tea farms and met with workers and farmers and government officials, managers, owners of companies, a whole spectrum. And it was absolutely fascinating to learn both the sort of differences in different locations and at different levels, but also to see the patterns, to see what was common across many of those perspectives that we gathered.
These two broad regions are also where the plantation model has been in play for the longest time, isn't it? So I think just sheer numbers, I imagine, coming out of these regions is huge, and therefore the need for understanding what human rights looks like here.
That's true, yes. Yeah. And in both regions, there's also, either a growing or well-established smallholder farmer sector as well. So it was very interesting to see the differences between those.
When you posed a question about human rights, what sort of responses did you hear from the various stakeholders?
So I think there's quite a wide variety of responses to that. There are, many within the tea industry who are very aware of the human rights issues, of the low pay, the, substandard housing, healthcare, education. We know, of course, that many of these things are provided by plantations, but they struggle to be able to afford to provide them to an adequate standard in many cases. But I think because we were looking at the whole value chain and not just, in a sense, blaming the producer, that made it easier for them to have those conversations. You know, when we made it clear that we're not saying, as many earlier reports have done, you know, this is terrible, you should do something about it. We are also asking them, you know, what would make it easier for you to provide these adequate services? What impact is it having on your commercial viability, the fact that you have to pay for all these additional services that maybe other industries don't have to pay with? You know, how is the downward pressure on prices impacting on your ability to do that? So people were happy to talk about that. There was some pockets of denial that there is any problem. There are some in the industry who, you know, probably have been in the industry for generations. They've maybe taken on a company or an estate from their father. And as we were discussing earlier, it is often from father to son. It's very rarely that women own these estates and companies. And they have, you know, a very deeply rooted connection with those companies and with those estates, and feel that they are doing the right thing. They've done it. They've done it this way all their lives. Their whole life is rooted in this way of working. And so when someone comes in and says, you know, that the human rights are being breached, it's very personal for them. And they don't see that there's anything wrong with it. The very common argument that we hear is, there's two very common arguments here. One is, you can't expect them, tea workers on plantations, to have the same standards of living as a middle-class person in the UK. One interviewee actually phrased it as, you can't expect them to have the same human rights. I mean, to be fair to him, I don't think he meant that. I think he meant the same standards. But there is this kind of attitude, and that was one of the root causes that we identified, an attitude towards tea workers that they are, you know, they're somehow less less deserving of comfort, of security. Another was that compared to people living outside the estate, they're better off. So they would compare them to people working on construction sites or quarries, industries which don't provide housing and healthcare and all the other benefits, which, obviously, it sounds amazing when you think that when you describe it like that. Whereas, what Thirst and many NGOs and people who work in the human rights world are saying is that you shouldn't be comparing any worker with another worker who's worse off. That's not the benchmark. The benchmark is the internationally agreed human rights, is the national regulation for what standard those benefits should reach. So I think a lot of people see the term human rights in a different way. They see it as a lot of people in tea producing countries, I think, see it as a Western kind of concept being imposed on them, and it's an extension of colonialism. We have to remember that human rights are internationally agreed, and that many countries, many of the tea producing countries, have ratified the International Labour Organization conventions that protect those rights. These are not something imposed from outside. They are a human right, and they are the rights of all human beings, wherever they live and whatever industry they work in.
When you speak to the people who work on the estates, the workers and the pluckers, what's their view and their attitude? Is there a better sense or awareness of human rights, or do they share some of the same views that management shares, because it's also something they have inherited?
A lot of people who I've spoken to who work on tea estates are not very happy because although, yes, they have lived like that for generations, I think nowadays people are much more aware of what they could be earning, or what life they could be having. They have access now to television, to the internet, and maybe also just generally, awareness of rights has increased. So workers, to some extent, I think, are mindful that, they should have better pay, that their children should have better education. I mean, I don't think I've ever met a tea worker who isn't struggling to raise more money to educate their children. They are all desperate to get them educated and get them out of the tea sector, which is something that the sector really needs to address and think about how they're going to run the estates or grow tea in the future. I have to say, we didn't interview a lot of tea workers or farmers for this study, because our original study, the Literature Review, covered many, many reports in which hundreds, if not thousands, of workers were interviewed. Because in this study, we were looking at the root causes, which tea workers and farmers themselves may not be aware of. We were looking at the whole industry and how it functions. So that there's a very small number of workers that we actually interviewed for this study. But obviously, Thirst never misses an opportunity to talk to tea workers and farmers when we can. They are aware of the impacts of these things, but they're not so aware of the root causes behind it. But occasionally you would get glimmers. So in some tea factory workers that I interviewed in Tanzania showed that they did understand that there was, an issue about the price that is received for the tea, and that's why it's hard for them to receive a better wage. I've spoken with a tea worker in India who, when I asked why do you think it's mostly women who are plucking tea, who are employed to pluck tea, and she said, because we are easier to boss. So there is a kind of some sort of understanding of why they are in the situation they are, but as I said, they're very keen to get their children out of it.
You've listed 9 root causes in the report, and I think bookending the entire study is the first one on pricing. The other end, you have resistance to change, One was very specific, very tangible. The others, rather intangible. So between the two, it seems like the whole spectrum of what's affecting the industry is all there. I wanted to understand how you've organized the report and what readers should keep in mind when we read it.
Yeah, that's a really astute observation, actually, about one being tangible and one being intangible. I think that's right. The first one that you mentioned, price, actually, the first one is a little bit more complicated than that. We've called it Economics 101 because, it is about the price, but it's about the fact that prices are low because there is this massive global oversupply of tea combined with a stagnation in demand. So, you know, high supply, low demand, obviously the price is going to be low. And yet governments still keep increasing the output of their tea. And yet there are organizations which still encourage farmers to increase their yield, increase their production. And until that stops, the price is not going to improve. It really is urgently needed for tea growing countries, companies, organizations to face the fact that there is too much tea now, and they've got to find a way of finding a balance between the amount of tea that's produced and the amount of demand that there is for it. So that was the first one, as you said. The last one, actually, the resistance to change was the 10th one. We had 9 root causes and then this resistance to change kind of underlying it all. And that is a really interesting one. We proposed this idea of organizational imprinting. It was originally found in animal behavioral studies where when an animal is born, a bird is hatched, they will imprint on the first living thing they see and assume that's their mother. Those studies were then expanded to see how human beings react in that way as well, very often. And then that was extended to organizations, to companies and to organizations. So we have looked at the characteristics of the tea industry and the extent to which it demonstrates indications of organizational imprinting. And there are many points at which, you know, it meets the criteria. So because it was created during the colonial era. And when I talk about the tea industry, I should clarify that, as I said, we're focusing on very much on this trade between South Asia, East Africa and Europe and the West. We were very aware that that's not the whole tea industry, that there is also huge tea industry in China, in other East Asian countries, and also other huge markets for tea, for example, the Middle East and Russia. But we're looking very specifically at a large part of the tea industry, and one which is rooted in this colonial past. And because it was created at that time, many of the systems and behaviours and attitudes and processes have been preserved very much intact from that time. And so as well as the kind of tangible, to use your word, things like the way that tea is traded, like the way that plantations are organized, the hierarchies, even down to, you know, the siren that goes off at 6 o'clock in the morning to get people up and going to the tea fields, all the way to the attitude that managers have sometimes shown towards workers, you know, in some cases, talking about them as if they are less than human. And, you know, how do you respect somebody's human rights if you don't see them as human? So, yes, those were two very important bookends. But I would say that the other root causes that we identified, they are all interconnected. So, you know, the colonial past is connected with the attitudes, which was one of the root causes. One of them was entrenched trading practices. That's obviously connected to colonialism, but it also affects the price. And so, you know, they are all interconnected. I wouldn't want to just pick one out and say we should work on this. It has to be looked at as a whole.
When you look at the multiple stakeholders, how big is the divide between the various groups, whether management and worker, men and women, small farmer, big estate? Do you see a big divide within the industry, or is there a little more cohesion that's sort of coming in? Because that too was one of the problems listed as a root cause, isn't it?
Yes, the fragmentation of the industry. At every level, this was what was interesting about the study, was that each of these root causes, we're not seeing them just at one level of the tea value chain, but throughout the value chain. So, for example, the sort of unequal power dynamics was one of the root causes. So you see it between women and men in plantations. You see it between the different hierarchies in a plantation. You see it between tea producers and the buyers, or tea producers and the brokers that broker the relationship between them and the buyers. You see it between the powerful supermarkets and the tea companies that they buy from. So, you know, all along the value chain is the same root cause playing over and over. And that we saw, again, you know, in the fragmentation as well. The tea industry is becoming more fragmented, I would say, because, you know, originally there was this plantation model, and as I said, a lot of it still remains intact. But there's, you know, a very rapidly growing smallholder farmer sector. Obviously, it's huge in Kenya, where there are, you know, over 600,000 smallholder farms who are part of the Kenya Tea Development Agency. But in other countries, there are also a growing number of smallholder farmers. I was very struck personally by the difference between workers on tea plantations, how they lived, how they were treated, how they felt about themselves, and smallholder farmers. When I was speaking to Dan about this a few months ago, I mentioned this, that you have a plantation which has labour regulations in place. In countries like India, there's the Plantation Labour Act. And yet, because of the way that plantations are historically structured, because of because the houses were built in the colonial era, and often are still the same structures as before, there's, you know, a risk that those workers actually are very much more subservient to the management. Their houses are smaller, are less, you know, well decorated, they're in less good repair. And the smallholder farmers, even though, you know, none of them were rich by any means, the ones that I met, and I'm this is very anecdotal, a proper, you know, study would need to be done of it, but they appeared to me to have more resources available. Their houses were better condition. They were often, you know, supplementing their tea with other crops, so they had crop diversity, which is also better for the environment. And but above all, they had self-respect, they had dignity, even down to, you know, a small detail like when you visited a worker on a tea plantation, often the person showing you around would just walk into the house without knocking, whereas the tea farmers were treated with much more respect, and that came through very strongly.
Thank you so much for this chat, Shobhita. As always, it was insightful and enlightening, and we hope it will open those windows into possibilities. Wishing you all the best for phase 3, and we look forward to catching up with you once phase 3 is done.
Me too, Aravinda. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Intrigued by what you heard in today's podcast? Would you like to learn more from our global network of TBiz journalists and tea experts? Remember to visit the TBiz website for more comprehensive coverage. That's www.t-biz.com. Thanks for listening. Farewell till next week.
Produced by Autovita Studios. Connect your voice to the world. For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger. For the ones who get it done.